At least you don't drink while peeing. That's a whole new level of weird right there. Welcome, everyone. It is Tuesday, October 3rd, 2017. Kind of a shitty day yesterday.
Yeah.
Tragedy on small and large counts.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we lost Tom Petty, which, you know, there aren't a lot of artists, musicians, particularly like him left.
Yeah.
You know, the ones who forged the trail are kind of dropping for our generation anyway.
And who would have thought that Tom Petty would be outlasted by Keith Richards?
Right.
Bob Dylan.
Right.
I think Roy Orbison's still alive. I think all.
So.
But yeah.
And on the back of the 273rd mass shooting of 2017 in America.
Yeah.
And I had this thing. I had this rant that I had all prepared, but I will save it. I think if you've listened to this show, you certainly know
where we stand,
how I and we stand on this. What doesn't make sense to me is, number one, if this person were brown or black, we would be having a very different conversation.
True.
The narrative would be framed very differently.
True.
Than it is. There are a number of politicians who continually vote to make it easier to get guns.
It's very hard to get guns.
It's very hard to get guns?
It's being sarcastic.
Yeah. There's a bill this week to make silencers easier to get. Mm-hmm. And look, I don't want to have a debate on where you stand on guns. And I will say this, there are a lot of people hiding behind a misinterpretation of the Second Amendment, and there are a lot of politicians in the back pocket of the NRA.
I think you and I just want less people to die.
I just want less people to die. Yeah. And you can make the case that, well, if there weren't guns, then people would use knives or rocks or clubs. That might be true, but you know what wouldn't happen? There wouldn't be a bunch of stones being thrown from the 32nd floor of a hotel at a crowd of people who showed up to a concert to listen to music.
Yep. And speaking of the, you know, power of photography, God, there's that image I saw yesterday of, I think it was a woman just like lying on the ground, seemingly dead, I'm assuming, you know, just her legs. It's just, you know. You see a single image like that, and it trumps 10,000 words, you know, of a story about it.
It's an awful thing. A friend of mine who I've known for years and years, his sister was at the show with her husband. They're fine, but was not a pleasant scene.
No.
So yeah, I mean, it's. I'm not going to preach about. But we need more than thoughts and prayers.
Agreed.
So, anyway, you know, this is a photography show, and we should probably get to it.
Can I recount a happy story?
Please.
From this last week?
I think a lot of us need happy stories right now.
So... I'm a bit of a history buff. I know you're a little bit of a history buff, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are history buffs. A friend of mine from high school and from middle school and from elementary school works at the FDR Library up in Hyde Park. Uh-huh. And he and I haven't seen each other in, I don't know, 20 years.
But we're friends on Facebook, and we got to talking one day, and I said, you know, maybe I'll come up there one day. I'll shoot you for my little series. And, you know, he's like, oh yeah, I'll give you a tour and, you know, the whole thing. So we had to move it a couple weeks ago because Fox News was coming in to do some kind of thing. And part of his job is to deal with sort of media stuff when it's there. So we rescheduled, and I went up last Wednesday. And I said, how'd the Fox News thing go last week? He goes, actually, they rescheduled for today, but I didn't want to move you again. So I'm going to have to like leave you for 20 minutes and go do this thing. And I was like, no, that's fine. You know, go do what you got to do. So by the way, very cool. If you ever get the chance to go to the FDR library up there and the house and the whole thing is really cool. Great exhibits. There's a whole show on a whole photo exhibit currently up there about the internment camps.
Oh,
and all of these WPA photographers, or, you know, post WPA photographers, all the people, you know, from the era,
right,
who went
right.
and shot the internment camps, and the people leaving San Francisco and, you mm-hmm. know, the West Coast mm-hmm. in general, which is excellent. So if you live anywhere in the area and you're a photo fan, you should go check out this exhibit because it's excellent. Anyway, the reason I bring this all up is that I went outside for a few minutes to make a phone call to my sister. And Cliff, my friend, says, you know, texts me. He says, you got to come in right now. Like, come in right now. So I like hop off the bench and I run inside, and he takes me upstairs to the archive library, which is where, you know, like the serious people go do research and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And apparently, because these sort of VIP people from the news were there, the archivist had pulled out some stuff to show them, to sort of, you know, including a pair of bearskin gloves that Stalin had given FDR at the Yalta conference.
Oh, wow.
And I got to touch them.
Wow.
And then, this is the cool one. She said, are you into FDR or Churchill? I was like, well, I'm into both, but what do you got? And she takes a manila folder and she opens it up. And Jeffrey, inside...
Is she wearing gloves?
Well, she didn't need to for this thing.
Yeah.
She opens it up, and inside a sheet of, you know, hard plastic is a piece of paper. And it is the first page of the second inaugural. So only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Right, 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 right.
The one he held in his hands that he read at the podium with handwritten notes on it.
Wow.
And, you know, and the reason I bring it up is, A, that's really cool. It was a fun story to recount and the whole thing. And if you're a history buff, that's the kind of stuff that makes you go, whoa, you know.
Right.
But it does sort of, you know, speak to our constant conversation about sort of physical objects and the things that mm-hmm. were there at the mm-hmm. time, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's an original print from something, or right. Somebody's camera, you know, that is like some famous camera, you know, this is the camera that they used to shoot, you know, they did a show of Karsh's portraits up at the MFA in Boston, I don't know, 10 years ago. And they had Karsh's 8x10 camera in there, and its mm-hmm. case and the whole thing. And, you know, and it's like, you see these things, and these objects have meaning because it's the thing that the other people touched. And it's funny. Right. It's not the object itself that has power most of the time. Usually it's the idea that this is sort of a relay race, and this is the baton, you know, they touched this and now I'm touching it, or, you know, that kind of thing. Like, it's,
well, I think it is why, museums like the Holocaust Museum, or the Museum of African American History and Culture, or the Japanese American Museum in Los Angeles are so impactful to us as visitors, because it's, yes, the photographs have power in and of themselves, but to have those objects that are part and parcel to that event, to have the object that's in the photograph actually there.
Yeah.
Imparts a deeper connection.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and that goes for, speaking of the Holocaust Museum, like where you walk through the sort of the cattle car, the train mm-hmm, car, you mm-hmm. know, that's in there. Holy cow.
I still haven't been to that one. I've been to the one in LA.
The DC one's pretty great.
Same way with the Museum of African American History. They've got the cars there. They've got, you know, the shacks that they disassembled one and then reassembled it.
Right.
Interesting fact, one of the cars that's in the lower level, the train car that's in the lower level, it's been there since they built the museum. They had to build the museum around it.
Oh, they put it in and then covered it up.
Then, and then built the museum around it, because there would have been no way to get it in after the fact.
That's pretty cool.
But it's, I mean, it's, you know, walking where, you know, people walked, or standing in, you know, a recreation, but a recreation from the original materials. It's humbling.
Yeah.
And it connects you in a way that, you know, simply having a keynote presentation or a PowerPoint doesn't.
Right. Yeah. It is. I mean, look, it costs money to print photographs. It costs money. You know, it's not like if you were going out and doing a daily project like I'm doing right now, and I went and made 8x10s of every single one that I did, or 11x14s, that would cost me quite a bit of money by the end of the year, you know. Mm-hmm. Worth it? That's, you know, up to you. But there are reasons why people don't do it. And it's not just time or laziness, you know, it is a pain in the neck or cost, but there is something to say for this idea that there's this thing, you know. I think we're just hardwired for this kind of stuff, you know, or I don't know. I mean,
I think there's something to that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then she also pulls out a top secret cable, a telegram from Churchill to FDR, thanking him for 500 Sherman tanks or something, you know.
Wow.
And you're just like, and it's stamped top secret, you know, like old school style, and the whole thing. It was really something. So I thank everyone up there. If anybody from there is listening, thank you. It was pretty great.
I think, John, write in or comment, friend of the show, John Wilkening started, mm-hmm. He finished his 365 project.
Oh yeah, so he was getting to the end there.
Went to Dallas for an alternative printing, like, you know, got a wet plate, got one of the 8x10 Polaroid portraits, and has started a new 365 project. And I think he's doing physical media for every single print. I think that's the way he set it out. Correct me if I'm wrong, John, but he's got a couple of them.
There will be a final one of each day, a final physical thing.
The first couple are up, and they're both Polaroids.
Oh, right. I saw one of those, and
the Guapo L.
Yes. The building. Yeah.
So there is something about the object, and I was thinking about. I mean, I think about objects a lot, and trying to figure out a way forward after the book and what comes next. And I like the idea of having a physical object in the mix somewhere. So either starting digitally and producing like a large internegative. Remember when friend of the show, Gary Yost, was doing the Palladium printing? And he did made an 8x10 internegative or transparency, and then contact printed that. I like the idea of that, where you start digitally and end up analog, or vice versa, where you start with film, scan it, and then end up digital, a digital print, still analog, but there's some digital manipulation in there.
Sure.
So I like the idea of mixing the two worlds.
I'd go so far as to say that I think even most of the analog photographers that you and I see, a lot of them have a digital level somewhere in there.
You know, some, I mean? Sort of digital, workflow.
Yeah, I mean, component. Other than the people who are actually just making even the wet plate stuff, it's like, well, they're eventually going to scan it, make prints from that. You know what I mean? They're not going to.
Right.
So it's funny. Almost all of us are using some sort of analog. If you're all digital, you're using analog somewhere, and the other way around, you know?
Right. I like the idea of that. I like the idea of a hand or a finger touching the work somehow, you know, whether it's handling the film and processing the film,
just big old fingerprint right there on the
right, that's right. Well, and I was thinking about the idea of shooting film, doing contact prints, and then deciding which frame I want to scan digitally, you know, take that to completion in the digital darkroom, and then print the final.
Say that one more time. I missed that.
Okay. So you shoot film.
Yep.
And you've got your page of negatives, do a contact print.
Okay.
Okay. And then decide, just like old school grease pencil, decide which frames are worth finishing.
Okay.
Scan those negatives in
right
to the digital realm.
Yep.
Do all your cleanup, spot toning, and trust me, if you've never done analog spot toning, consider yourself blessed and lucky because it's a pain in the butt.
Yeah.
It's awful. And I was never very good at it. So that kind of cleanup, easier to do, and then go ahead and print it again, you know, out onto paper. But you would then have a contact print and a final print as reference. And I love that idea because I've gone back to this and I've said it many times on the show that that Magnum Contact Sheets book, if you don't own that, that is a terrific, I've learned more about photography and photographers and working a subject from that book than probably any other book, you know, of a similar ilk.
Let me ask you a question. This is an opinion mm-hmm. question. Do you, you know, we used to work at 12 frames or 24 frames or 36 frames, depending mm-hmm. on, you know, format and whatever.
Right.
Do you think there's any sort of magic in that sort of rounding of number of images to look at? And for
what
example,
do you mean? Instead of like 15 or 42 or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah. Instead of, yeah. Like, is there something special about a smaller number like that? Let's say tomorrow I go down and I take pictures of you and I shoot 115 photos or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that too much for the mind to try to choose from?
I don't know.
See what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah.
Even though lots of people in the 80s and 90s were shooting 53 rolls of film when they went and shot somebody, you know, they're like the famous things, like magazine things, and there's an entire table of film backs, you know, that they're just swapping out every 10 seconds.
Yes, but you still had to pause, whether it's to grab a new camera or to let your assistant load the back of a, you know what I mean? There was still a pause. Sure. Where you had an opportunity to maybe reflect on what you'd shot so far, or have a little bit of a conversation with your subject, or change a light, or you know, look at, rather than just brr, brr,
brr, brr, or if you're Platon to go into like a praying pose,
right.
I'll tell you a little story. There's a guy named Carl Beatty who was one of my professors at Berkeley, and he was he's like a Grammy Award winning recording engineer. And he's this hardcore old school sort of analog guy, right? You know, old school tape kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he recorded Love Shack. You know, he's like that guy, right? And
not a sonic masterpiece by any means, but a fun song.
Sounds pretty good, actually. But yes, so he
it's no Dark Side of the Moon is all I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. But he was working in a studio once, and you know, and you'd say, all right, let's work on the bridge or whatever it is. All right, bring it back to a minute 42 and hit play. Right? And then it starts playing and he goes through the bridge and it gets to the end, and a tape operator or assistant will get it back to there and hit it. And you'd go over the same thing a few times trying to figure out whatever the problem was or, you know, whatever. And when he started working on digital, he used to do that. And some assistant said, look, I could just grab this region and have it repeat. So it gets to the end and it goes right back to the beginning. And it just, you know, this constant loop. And he said, like, three loops in, I was like, stop the tape. Like, we can't do it that way. I need, mm-hmm. you know, I need it to stop and I need it to be off for a minute. And then I need it to start again. I can't have it just go, you know? So like, there's this argument for, I was shooting some stuff last night and I actually ran out of space on one of my cards and I had to go find another card. And it was a little bit like changing film, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, it's rare that I, you know, I just happened to be at the end of a card and I was like, oh man, oh shoot, I can't delete any of this right now. Let me go find another card. And so I ended up having 30 or 40 pictures on two different cards, you know, 40 on one, and 40 on the other. So it was almost like two rolls of film.
Which I love. I mean, I use 16 gig cards. That's it. I don't use anything bigger.
Yeah. But 16 gig cards on your camera, probably.
It's still a lot of pictures.
Yeah. Poop ton of pictures.
You know, 16 megapixel raw files is still a lot of pictures. But, and I've got a couple eights lying around too. I like that idea. You know, going back to what we were saying, I like the idea of a pause. And I liked the idea of thinking about what I was shooting. While you were loading the next thing. I mean, when I started shooting in high school, I was the sports guy for yearbook. So I was shooting, in fact, I was just talking about this with Fielding over the weekend. I was shooting water polo, men's water polo.
I'm sorry, you had water polo at your high school?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We had an incredible water polo team. So I was shooting men's water polo, women's volleyball, and baseball. And the idea of you've got to anticipate what's going to, first of all, you have to learn the players because you can kind of learn what they do and when they do things, and you want to catch them at their best, right? You have to learn the game. You have to really pay attention to the game. You have to, your subject, whatever it is. But there was that break where you could kind of pause and reflect and go, okay, am I where I need to be? Or should I be on the other side of the pool? Or should I be, on the other baseline? Or I like that more so than just firing off 700 pictures
sure.
and then going, okay, I got it.
Yeah. Yeah. Whenever I listen to non-photo podcasts, I was listening to, I think, ATP, the Accidental Tech podcast, with John Syracuse and those guys. And Marco or Casey or one of them was just like, oh, how you take good pictures. Like, you just take a ton of pictures, and some of them will be good.
No.
And it's like, yes, that's something that people do, but that's not the way to think about it.
And, why does photography get single? So, okay, Marco, do you just write a bunch of code and hope that some of it's good?
Well, yeah, that's kind of what it felt like. And, I don't know these guys personally, so, whatever. But it was a little bit of a, no, that's not the way to do it.
Just write a bunch of sentences and see if there's a story.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. It was a little weird. Like, it made me feel a little like, ugh, no, you guys are missing it. You're missing it. But
it's interesting.
They're not photo people, right? So.
No, but it's interesting that photography is, I can't think of another creative discipline where the metaphor, the mechanics of spray and pray come into play.
True.
Where you just perform as many of these actions as possible and hope that something is good.
Yeah.
I can't think of another one.
It's a little dismissive.
It's a lot dismissive.
Yeah. It might even be, people say, go write, write, and eventually something good will come out. But it's a little different than that.
But you're still thinking about writing. You're still thinking about the words. You're narrowing it down.
Yeah. And it also assumes that people who are good photographers are only doing that because they're taking lots of pictures. There's a lot of good, really great photographers who don't take many pictures.
Don't
at
take
all.
A lot of pictures. Yeah, sure. Sure.
Yeah. Sorry, I cut you off.
No, it's all right. All right. I mean, I tend to think of some of these things as, writing, I think of it more as sculpture, where you're starting with these large chisels and you refine and refine and refine.
Right. Which in some ways is also the process of post-production in the digital age.
Sure.
In some ways, right? It's a very similar thing. I think that the thing about painting or sculpting or writing or all of these things, they have they have time as an element. Photography has 125th of a second.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Time is your currency there. Yeah, sure.
Exactly. Sure. So it's not like you get a whole lot of chance to refine it. I mean, and especially when you ever take a picture that you really liked, but there was something about it that was off or technically wrong, and you try to recreate it, you try to go back
all the time.
he's like first half every time,
right. Come on. No,
but do you ever feel that way and look at a picture that you're just like, oh, this is so right, except for I didn't like that car back there, let me go try to take it again.
Yeah.
And you can never ever get back there.
Yep. Even during the day, we went to Harper's Ferry a few months ago now, and they had some reenactors there. And there was a guy sitting, I just caught him. He was just looking at his pocket watch, and it wasn't in character per se. I mean, he was dressed in character, but that particular gesture, that motion wasn't in character. He just wanted to see what time it was.
Right.
And I happened to be walking by and I was like, hold it. Can I take your picture? And he's like, sure. What do you want me to do? I said, just don't move. Just look down at your watch like you were doing. That's all. And click, click, click. I took two or three shots.
Right.
But in the background, you've got these muted colors, dirt road, muted buildings. But in the background was a guy wearing a baseball cap and like a bright blue shirt.
Yeah.
And it just... Yeah, it just ruined it. It ruined it. And, you know, I tried it in post. I tried to selectively change the color, but the shape just, it threw everything off. And I remember looking at the back of the camera later on in the day, because we kind of kept going, and I wanted to go back and get it again, but, you know, it just wasn't the same. He's
going, the light's different.
The light's different. He wasn't sitting the same way. I mean, I took a couple and thanked him for his time I said, hey, you know, there was a distraction in the background. Could we do this again? And I tried to get, you know, but it was a posed gesture at that point,
right,
instead of just a natural movement. I caught him between movements.
Yep.
And to your point, you can't go back. You can't do it again.
Can't go back to the green.
Yeah.
So it's while photography is an iterative process, you're not iterating on the same thing over and over again. You're iterating on variations of the same thing.
Sure.
And I think that that's what makes it a little bit different. So that people assume, because of that, you know, you can just keep iterating and eventually you'll get somewhere. And it's like, it doesn't really work that way. You know,
It might work that way if you're, I don't know, a still life photographer or a food photographer, where time is less of a factor in this, right, in that way.
I mean, okay, here's the problem. Just a quick forward looking thing. Famous picture by our photographer of the week this week, in one of those articles you put in there, is one of the frames a couple seconds before the frame that's famous.
Yeah.
And it's not nearly as interesting.
Yeah. Well, so same you with could argue that a lot the of the napalm these, girl. The,
exactly.
There are frames before and after that just don't work.
Yep. 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 So it's hard to completely dismiss the idea that it's all that there isn't an element of sort of luck involved. You
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the idea that's all you need to do in order to get good photos is to me incorrect. But
okay, let me ask you this. Let's play devil's advocate for a minute.
Sure.
Photographs by let's go back to sports for a second, because that's kind of what we were talking about a little bit. Sports photographers today have
video, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, if you're using the Sony A9 or the even the Olympus
20
EM1,
frames a second,
you've got 20 frames. The Olympus shoots, I think, 60 frames per second, full raw.
I mean, it's just like it says. I remember going to the U.S. Open 10 years ago, and somebody had whatever the equivalent was, a 1D Mark II or something like that. You know,
like a 4.5 frame per second or something.
It was like, you know what I mean? Every time somebody, it would hit across the net, like, and you could hear, and then you go across the net, go across the net. He would just move from one side to the other and just shoot every single shot the guy hit.
Every volley. Yeah.
Every volley. Yeah. And I'm
okay,
just like,
so that brings up where I'm going with this.
Okay.
So somebody like Neil Leifer, let's say,
mm-hmm.
that iconic, well, choose any one of several iconic shots that he's either the overhead shot of the boxing match, or
my favorite of all time.
Yeah. Or Ali, you know, kind of holding his glove, standing there, you know, is he a better photographer for being there and anticipating that moment or those moments than someone who could just capture the entire range of motion and then choose the best one?
Yeah, but we haven't seen the shots before or after the one of where he knocks down Liston.
True, but it was regardless that there would have been a significant amount of time between those shots relative to what we can capture now.
Yeah. He would have had to take a half a second or a second and a half to, you know, reset. In fact, it's funny, in that picture, you can look behind Ali. If you look behind him, and here's, I happen to have it open since you mentioned it. I just pulled it open. I put it in Skype there for you. Look at all of the people and all the cameras behind him, right? And they're all shooting with Leica's old Nikon, probably the original F or something like that.
Right.
The guy's got a Rolly,
like a 2.25 Rolly. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, these guys are, they're not shooting 20 frames a second. They're not shooting 2 frames per second. So the whole cadence of it was different.
You've got to take, this is the other thing that, you know, people who have never shot analog, you've got to take the camera away from your face, advance the film, and then put it back. So there is that moment of recomposition, not just moving your eye around. I mean, it's a different animal.
Yeah. You had to. It felt more like, I would imagine, sort of hunting than.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like you're waiting to get your arrow back, and you got to wait for the right moment, you know?
Right. Bow hunting specifically.
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
You know? So I don't know. It is interesting. It's a completely different thing. And you're saying that, back to what you were saying, that people nowadays take a whole lot of pictures, back in the day they didn't. And I remember when that new Sony, the A9, came out, everyone's like, oh my God, it'll be amazing for sports photographers, because, you know, you weren't getting it at 12 frames per second, but now at 20 frames per second, right, you're really going to get the picture.
Right. It's like, here's the thing. If you're not getting what you need at 12 frames a second, I don't know that 14, an additional 8 is going to get you where you need to go.
Right. I don't know. And maybe, you know, we're old people saying that and we're missing something, but like, it just feels, I don't know.
It feels to me like in some cases, and this is not a blanket statement by any means, but in some cases, as the technology, as photographic technology increases and gets better, and as these cameras get faster and more capable, the barriers that were at least partially responsible for producing those iconic photographs, and maybe even necessary to produce them, are gone.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're saying as technology improves, the barriers to laziness fall? What are you saying?
No, I'm saying that he Leifer, for example, was working within limitations of his tools.
Yes.
If you take those limitations away, and he could have just sat there and captured, you know, 300 frames in the space of, you know, several seconds.
Right.
There feels like in that situation, there's less craft and less purpose and less intent than the way he shot these pictures.
I'm there for purpose and intent. Can I flip it one more time?
Yeah, sure.
Maybe there were pictures that people missed back then because they didn't have 20 frames per second.
Absolutely. 100%.
And that's 100%. The part that it's hard to say, well, yeah, maybe they are getting things today that they wouldn't have gotten yesterday.
Right.
Whether or not that actually will make a huge difference.
And and we're picking and choosing which parts of craft we care about.
Right.
So Leifer had to decide what film stock, had to decide, you know, what shutter speed, what aperture, how he was going to light this thing from the top.
Right.
Whereas now you could show up at that same event with an A9, put it in auto or aperture priority and not care a bit about all of those factors.
Sure.
So on one hand, it frees you up to only focus on composition. But for the people for whom those other factors are factors to craft, it takes that away.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of, remember you and I were talking about, you were making sort of a little bit of a straw man attack on people who argue that you need to be in manual mode. You remember that you were talking about that last week? You were just sort of like, and some people say, if you're not a manual, you're not doing it right, or you're not a pro.
Well, they do.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do.
Is it a straw man?
Well, just because, like, you know, it's not like everybody says that. Some people
say
that.
I didn't say everybody says that, but there are those photographers who say, you know, they will look down on you if you're shooting in program or aperture mode.
Okay, and fair enough.
That's silly.
So I have been finding myself shooting in what's called TAV mode on my camera.
What is that? Time value? Is that shutter priority?
It's shutter and aperture priority, and it takes care of ISO. So I can choose what aperture and what shutter speed I want, and it makes sure the exposure works as far as sensitivity.
So it's essentially manual with auto ISO.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's really kind of nice. I've been shooting for the last few days. I've been using that mode, and it's although, you know, it's funny because before I would take a picture and realize that the shutter speed was way too low. You know what I mean? Like to do aperture priority, take a shot at, say it's later in the day, the sun's going down, I'm at ISO 800, I'm at 5.6. Mm-hmm. And then I don't realize that the shutter speed's down to a 30th of a second or something like that.
Can you not set like a minimum shutter speed on that camera?
Well, talking if I was in aperture priority mode.
Okay.
I was manually setting my ISO. And it used to be the kind of thing where I'd go, I got to bring up that ISO. And I'd bring it up to 1600, you know, and then now I'm at 60th of a second, right?
Right.
This thing likes to be, I think it's currently set at either 60th or 80th or maybe 100th of a second to right. shift up to the next one. So I find
it's going
to
depend on which lens you're using too.
Right. Of course. Yeah. But it's also fine. I find it using much higher ISOs than I would normally use. You know, like I'll be out and it'll be getting a little darker and I'll have my lens and I'll set up the shot and I'll take the picture and it looks fine and whatever, because this camera is, you know, pretty amazing when it comes to that kind of stuff. But I'll come home and I'll be like, oh, that set it at 3200 outside. It was, you know what I mean? Because it was trying to give me what I asked for, which,
right.
You know, which it was giving me what I asked for. I would just never, as an old school photographer who was terrified of even 1600 ISO back in the day.
Sure.
I still am a little gun shy, even though 32 or 64 looks perfectly fine for most stuff, you know?
Right.
But it's not scared like I am, because it's a camera and not a person. Right. But it,
there's that.
But yeah, anyway, I just wanted to point out that I thought that was actually a cool way of shooting. It's like, it's basically manual, but it makes sure that it's sort of like manual with training wheels.
Right. You know? Well, that's the X-T2 with all of the manual dials and functionality, you can kind of, and a lot of other cameras, actually, you can create your own shooting modes. So gone are the, you know, PASM. You can decide at any point, do you want to use auto aperture, manual shutter, vice versa, or both
auto? And you can set that up as custom mode two.
Yeah.
Do you ever use the custom modes or the user modes on cameras?
I have my X-Pro set up to... I have three different modes. I have one color and two black and white. It's not a shooting mode per se. It's, you know, plus one highlights, plus two shadows, you know, black and white with a yellow filter.
And you're shooting JPEG theoretically in these situations?
RAW plus.
And do you usually use the JPEG or do you usually work on the RAW?
Depends on where it's going.
Yep.
You know, there are so many photographs that I have both, but I use them straight out of camera, especially the, I mean, you know, we've talked about this a lot. The Fuji JPEGs are gorgeous.
That's why I asked.
With, you know, with some tweaking, you can get them to look the same, but you know, look what I'm doing with them. I mean, I have to look at the end use case, you know, and there are a lot of times I've gone out and I've just shot JPEG.
As somebody who's known you for a long time and obviously talked to you for hundreds of hours, I could totally see you being the kind of person who says, you know what? No, I'm just this camera, the JPEGs look amazing. I'm not going to get sucked into that thing, or I'm going to limit myself so I don't get sucked into that thing. So I'm going to shoot JPEGs and that's all I'm going to shoot.
Yeah. I mean, because then I did that
with my X100S or whatever it was.
Yeah. It gets you back to shooting basically a film stock.
Right.
You know, this is what I've got. I've got a roll of Ektachrome. I don't have Kodachrome. I wish I did, but I don't. So here's what I'm shooting.
Which is what the Fujis are good at in the first place.
Sure, they're terrific.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you're making me want another Fuji.
Well, get one.
What is the new one? The X100F?
X100F, because it's the fourth.
Oh, is that why it's the F?
Yeah, the S was the second, the T was the third, and the F is the fourth.
You know what? I didn't even put that together.
Yep.
Did you now what they're going to do for the fifth
one? No, that's why they did. What they're going to do for the fifth one is, and so the F2 and then the sixth one, the order, there's already an S. So is there going to be an S2?
Did the T was pretty good, right? The X100T was well regarded.
Uh-huh.
Cause you can get
you can probably get them for $700-800 now, right?
Like new 850 on KEH, bargain with battery and charger 668, but their bargain is like fully working, kind of could be banged up a little bit.
So you've got built-in ND filters. You've got, it's the same lens from the T to the F.
Yep. I'm thinking for like a travel camera, in which case I don't need a lot of, the 16 megapixels is fine for a travel camera.
Yep.
For the kind of stuff
so
that
I'm
doing.
The T has the same sensor as the XT1.
Right.
And the F has the same sensor as the X Pro 2 and the XT2.
Right. If I had my druthers, of course, I'll take the... Now, there was some talk, and I know I brought this up once before, but I don't remember the answer, that the new sensor doesn't have quite the same magic that the old one had.
Is that true? I have read the same things. I don't know if there's any empirical data, but I've read that it just doesn't... Somehow it doesn't look... That the 16 megapixel X-Trans sensor was somehow the sweet spot. I don't know... I haven't looked at it enough to know why.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, that means I could probably get an X100S on eBay for like next to nothing.
If that's what I wanted to do. I don't know the differences between the S and the T other than
faster
focus speeds.
Yeah,
that are they the same sensor?
Faster.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's the same sensor. It's the same sensor back to the original, as far as I know. It's just that now they've just gotten better at it was just better processors and stuff to keep it moving, you know?
So the F is the first one since the original to use a different sensor.
Yes, as far as I know. And I mean, they may have improved the sensor slightly over time, but it's pretty much the same sensor. Yeah. They must have made a lot of those sensors.
I would imagine. Yeah. I mean, look, that's kind of the genius of their line, right? You order a ton of sensors and you can use that same sensor in three or four different camera models.
Yeah. Here's a guy selling an X100S for $475. That's a good price.
There you go.
Good working condition, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, sorry about that. See, you get sucked into camera stuff. So I'm going away this weekend, then I'm going to Montreal in a couple weeks. And I'm just trying to figure out what I should bring as a camera. I wish I could get myself a nice X100. If somebody has one they want to lend me, I'll trade you for something for a few weeks. You still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Hey, I'm going to the Eddie Adams workshop this weekend.
Right. That's what you said.
Which is going to be, it's going to be pretty interesting. So I'll have a full report on that next week, which is going to be fun. But spending 4 days with 300 other photographer, photo nerd people is going to be,
is this in New York?
It's in upstate New York. It's actually, yeah. You know what it is? It's about 10 minutes away from Bethel, where the original Woodstock thing was.
Okay.
It's like right around the corner from the Woodstock thing.
From that farm?
Yeah, from the farm.
Is that farm, do you know, non sequitur, but is it still just one farm or has it been chopped up into other stuff?
I think it's still one thing, and I think that there's some sort of... thing there, event there or whatever, you know what I mean? Like a plaque and the whole thing, you know what I mean? Like
do they still hold concerts?
Yeah. Cause I think they actually have built a thing there to have shows there. I'll have to look it up, but yeah. All right. What else? We have other stuff to talk about here. What do you want to do? Do you want to,
jump into Lauren's
talk about
thing?
Lauren's thing?
Yeah, sure.
Here, read her thing. Let's see what it says.
Lauren Shin, thank you, Lauren, for writing in. If you'd like to write in, podcast@ontakingpictures.com, we'll get you there. That was a very Leo thing, right? That was kind of Leo-y.
Yeah, that was Leo-esque.
Yeah, if you'd like to write it. Of course, he's got that laugh. Leo's got that that laugh that I can't do.
Yeah.
Lauren Shin, what motivates you to show up in your creative business endeavors on the days when you just don't feel like it? Is it others? Parentheses, serving, reaching out, a sense of obligation, and parentheses. Is it yourself, parentheses, doing something you love to do and the freedom that comes with being your own boss, and parentheses, or is it financial, parentheses, you need / want to get paid this week, and parentheses. And if it's financial, do you ever feel guilty for that being the motivating factor?
You have an answer?
Okay. It's for both.
It's for both of us.
Do I have an answer? What made motivate? Well, you have to do something. You know, you can't just watch Gotham all day.
Sure you can.
I've tried it.
It's a terrible show.
Yeah, it's not great.
I was watching Quantico last night. You ever watch that?
No.
Anyway, go ahead.
No. What motivates you to show up? The work, just doing the work show motivates me. I like the process of doing what it is doing.
Okay, there are obviously days where both you and I got nothing creative going on in our heads, right? Like just not feeling it, right?
Many days.
But even on those days, do you ever not enjoy sitting down and, for lack of a better word, kind of futzing around with stuff?
Yes.
There are days where you don't enjoy that.
Oh, yeah. Most of the writing for the book, for Photographer by the Letter, I did not like it at all.
Okay.
I didn't find a
lot
of joy.
Maybe writing is not
it.
For you, Jeffrey.
Yeah, well, not that kind of writing, not the technical kind of writing. I enjoyed doing the research for this book more than I enjoyed interpreting that research to make it interesting and not so dry.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, I enjoyed the research part. The drawings, I loved doing the drawings. The photographs, I loved going out and doing the photographs. But if I'm not feeling motivated, sometimes I'll go for a run in the forest. Sometimes I'll go, you know, rake leaves or something in the front or the back. If I do something unrelated to the task at hand, and sometimes I try and just push through. I force myself. No, you got to go sit and create. You got to go make something. You got to go write or photograph.
Stop being lazy.
Yeah. If it's not there, it's not there.
Yeah.
So sometimes if you disconnect and just go do other things, you'll get that idea. You'll get that spark and go, oh, wait a minute. I know what I can do.
I think that there are people who fantasize about what being a creative for a living and for the rest of it is like, you know, basically like, oh my God, it'd be amazing if I could just sit there and make stuff all day.
It's not.
It's really hard.
Yeah. talk to any professional photographer. I would challenge you to find a photographer, and maybe they're out there, but there aren't many, that spend more than 20% or 25% of their time taking pictures. Most of it's you're hustling clients, you're setting up, you're doing the pre-production.
Yep.
I remember talking to Dan Winters, and he said, you know, I spend days, sometimes weeks, prepping for a shoot, and when I get there, I spend an hour or 2 hours on the shoot, and that's it. So the actual time with my camera in my hand is minimal compared to the hours, days, or weeks of pre-production and post-production to make those pictures happen.
Right. Yeah.
And you've experienced this.
Yeah. And it's also hard. When creativity is your hobby and you can kind of come to it when you want to come to it and it's an escape and all those things, it's very different than not only when money depends, when rent depends on it, you know, that kind of thinking, where, okay, I have to produce because I have to eat this week. But also
even that is out of your hands.
But that is largely out of your hands. Yeah.
You could go, gosh, Bill, you really need to go get a cover for Rolling Stone this week. Well, you know, let me know how that works out. Exactly. Yeah. You can't just call Rolling Stone and go, I'm ready.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. All right. Okay. I'm feeling creative today.
Yeah. I've got a slot for you at 2:00. Bring by?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. So there's that, but there's also this, you know, this sense of not foreboding, but it's daunting for people to be constantly expecting you to come up with new stuff all the time. You know, it's because it's somehow when you're doing it professionally, you're now actually up on the pedestal in the hot seat all the time, seemingly.
It can be that way. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Or at least it feels that way.
Yeah. I remember,
and that's
asking,
exhausting, you know.
I asked my stepmother years ago, because my stepmother is a fabulous painter, always has been, wonderfully creative, and she's just incredible. And I asked her, this must have been in high school, You know, why don't you paint? Why don't you paint for a living? And she said to me, because it would take the joy out of it.
Yep.
If I had to paint, if I had to paint for a living, if I had to paint for rent or food or car insurance, it takes the joy out of it for me.
True.
I choose to keep that something that I do. I paint for the people that I love. I paint as gifts. I paint for therapy, whatever the reason is.
Yeah.
Doing it because she had to do it and she tried that, but it felt very different than doing it because she wanted to do it.
Yeah. And it's also a self-motivation thing, right? You know, say what you will about working for someone else and being under the thumb of the man and whatever it is, but you don't have to come into work every day and go, okay, so what is it that I'm supposed to do here all day? It's, you know, people are telling you what you need to have done. You know, they're hiring you because there's stuff that needs to get done. So there's sort of, you automatically have a to-do list, which is...
There's a task list waiting for you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And medical benefits. But yeah.
Sometimes,
yeah. Good point. So it's interesting. I find it this way. There are times when I am just not feeling it. Or, you know, I wake up with a migraine like I do once every couple of weeks. And I'll just say, screw it, and like lay back down, right? Because that's my depressive excuse, right? I'll just say like, it doesn't matter. I can lose an hour or two. I'm just going to go take a nap.
Right.
And I'll go take a nap and I'll wake up and I'll feel far worse after the nap than I did before the nap.
Really?
I'll be in an even worse place afterwards because I'll feel guilty about having wasted time, right?
Yeah. When you nap, just non sequitur, when you nap.
Do I set timers?
Well, that and what is your kind of default target? Are you an hour napper? Are you?
I used to be I'm just going to lay down and I'll wake up when I wake up, which if I naturally did it, I'd probably sleep for an hour and a half, which is too long.
What I have taken to doing, and this, I read about this and it actually works for me, is I'll do a couple shots of espresso and then I'll go lay down for 20 minutes. I set a timer for 20 minutes and 9 times out of 10, when that timer goes off and I get up, I feel amazing.
Well, yeah. It's called caffeine.
No. But I mean, the espresso actually lets me crash. I crash harder.
Oh, I see. See, I will now set a timer for 15 minutes or 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. But invariably when the timer goes off, there's iOS 11 is even worse because it says, would you like to repeat this timer?
Right.
And so I'll do 15 minutes and then 15 minutes and then 15 minutes. So basically I'm taking little 15 minute chunk naps. Anyway, the point of this is to say I take naps, and naps, as a general rule, I feel worse after them, even though I keep going back to them. Naps are my heroin. That's like, it's really bad.
Yeah. Hey, random question.
Yeah, sure.
Have you found iOS less stable than iOS, or iOS 11 less stable than 10?
I have not found any real stability issues. I know other people have. I have not had anything.
My phone has locked up more in the last 2 weeks since I've upgraded than in the 2 years prior.
I have, every once in a while, Overcast lately has been kind of locking up to where it won't let me do anything in the interface, or I can open up a podcast, but I can't hit play.
Yeah, and I can't do anything. I have to do a hard reset where you do the home and power.
You might want to back it up and, you know,
maybe start over again.
Clean slate. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Anyway, so I've realized that even if I'm making work that I am not super happy with, I'm happier when I'm making work. So that is why I do it, because it's like my antidepressant. I don't do it, I feel worse. So even if when I feel like I'm not feeling it or it's not happening, I know that if I just start something, if I can get myself to start something, I'll feel better because it's the doing the thing that makes me feel better. So
do you have expectations on what the thing has to be? And the reason I ask this is when I'm making a painting, and I'm writing a post about this, when I'm making something, I have to put time, effort, and money just to get to zero, because I have to build the substrate. So I've got to go get plywood, cut it, get my framing material, build the frame, glue it, staple it, gesso it. So there's time and effort and money before I even start, air quotes,
right,
the picture. So I have an expectation that this has to be something because I've put in already time, effort, and money. I don't give myself the same room to play that I would if I were just using a sheet of, you know, Kilimanjaro watercolor paper or something.
Right. Well, maybe you should, I think in your case, you probably need to find a way to let go of that because you got to get back to it. Yes, you're spending time, but time you have, money, how much money are we actually talking? $20, $30?
It's not a lot of right. money. And especially right. because I can make a bunch of them at once.
Right. My point is it's
different than just taking out a sheet of paper out of the drawer yep, and going, yeah, okay, let's just see where this goes.
Yeah, absolutely. The one of the good things about digital photography, I think, is that it's allowed us to get back to that sort of just messing around stage. I mean, there for every shutter actuation I do on my relatively expensive camera, theoretically, I'm burning that shutter and there will be a day where it just doesn't shutter anymore. Although I've never had a camera shutter fail. Have you?
No, I have not.
Okay.
Yeah. but then again, I've never owned a Nikon D750.
Oh! Did they have a lot of problems?
I don't know.
Is that famous?
Some people reported okay. shutter issues.
So there is part of me that thinks, you know, if I go take 500 pictures just to mess around, I'm like, you know, spending... I'm chipping away at the price of my camera every time I use it in some way, you know, in a way okay. that you don't in another camera.
Let me jump in on this.
Yeah.
So... If that's the case,
yep.
And I think I kind of know the answer to this, but if that's the case, then why wouldn't you have an X100F or a Rebel or something
right. some
to just
crappy little
go
camera.
And play? And I suspect it gets back to messing around with photography really isn't your thing.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I mean, obviously there are times when even... in my daily portrait, I'll just, oh, well, let's try something different and weird. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right, like, but you're doing the daily portrait as an assignment to yourself.
Yes.
You yeah. rarely just take the camera out and go, I'm just going to go spend 4 hours wandering around shooting.
Yeah, I never do that. Yeah, although, it's funny enough, was I looking at, whose pictures was I looking at?
I don't know.
I was looking at someone's pictures. Actually, you know what? It might have been Matheson's pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And just looking at, you know, these sort of architecturally kind of things in the city, maybe it was him. It was one of our listeners.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, oh, I could take that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? And I have before, you know, when I happen to have my camera and I happen to see some angular kind of thing and I'll take a shot. And I sometimes think to myself, I should grab a tripod and my camera and go into the city and shoot, not people, not any of that stuff, shoot architectural kind of stuff. Because I mean, I can do it just fine. And maybe that would be a different something just to like stretch my legs in a different direction. I haven't gotten around to it cause I've been busy doing, you know, the other stuff, but yeah, every once in a while I think about doing that, but no, I don't generally mess around. Although it's funny. There's a picture up in our bathroom right now that I took with my phone. I walked by an empty store, like a retail store that had an escalator in it. And I shot a picture through the window. I actually stuck the camera up to the window. So it was like perfectly still, you know, and lined it up and took this picture and it came out great. And I made like a little 10x10 inch print of it and put it up in the bathroom. And that picture I actually really like. So there's times when I think to myself, oh, I should do more stuff like this. Cause I enjoy stuff like this. I guess part of it is that I could get sort of just, that would be a hobby because I don't see any business in that. You know what I mean? Like that doesn't help me make a living in photography per se, you know, beyond it maybe stretching my creative stuff in a way that I normally wouldn't. You know what I mean?
Right.
But there's not a lot of money in architectural photos of buildings.
Just to play devil's advocate.
Yep.
And this is maybe a big question for an entire show. How do you get better if you're only ever doing it when there's a reason to do it? It's like you're constantly
yeah, that's a good question.
You're constantly on photographic on the job training, you know, because you're only doing it when there's a job involved. So how
Or I make jobs for myself.
So. Yeah, or you make jobs for yourself, right. But my point is there's very little. I mean, you and I are kind of in the same boat in that, that there's not as much play
as
there probably could, maybe even should be.
I mean, I see a lot of the stuff that I do for my daily ones. I consider those, I don't take them that seriously. I mean, sometimes I'll take a lot of time and I'll be very happy with the results. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it'll be less time. And like I took a picture of a guy named David Stock, who is an excellent photographer, by the way. You should go look at his stuff. At a gallery down the street, and I bumped into him and we were talking, and I was like, oh, you mind if I shoot you for my thing? And I went outside the door and shot him through the door. So it's like this blue door and he's like inset in the window inside. Mm-hmm. I rather like that picture. You know, it didn't spark the flames of my readers, but like I thought it was actually really successful in a way that, oh, I wouldn't normally have taken that shot. And I was happy with having done something in my way different. You know,
right.
So there is at least some level of play in all this. And the nice thing about doing a million of them in a year is that you can ebb and flow through taking things seriously and playing and taking a quick shot and taking a lot of time. And, you know, they don't all have to be the same process.
Sure.
I think in that way, that's where my play comes in is playing around with, I don't do it the same way every time. You know what I mean? Like I imagine it this, the people who do say golfing, you know, and they work on their swing and it's like, we're going to deconstruct the swing and put it together again. And here's the back thing and the downswing and the follow through. And you know, those crazy people who turn it into like a muscle memory kind of thing.
Right.
I try to.
Golfers who are listening to the show are cringing at your metaphor right now.
But you know what I'm talking about. I think that's a pretty safe thing, because you always hear these things. Oh, Tiger Woods, you know, in the last season is like taking his swing apart and put it back together again and whatever. I think that there is a lot of, there's something dangerous in sort of creative muscle memory. Not dangerous, dangerous, but just, you know, there's, I think that's part of the problem. Oh, this worked before. It'll work again. So yeah, why don't we just do that? That feels good. That feels easy. This, you know, I know how to do this.
Sometimes if it feels easy, you're doing it wrong though. Right?
Yeah. Right. Or it's too easy and now you're not doing anything really new. So why are you even taking the picture? So I think that there's, you know, maybe that's a whole topic for another show too. So I think that the creative muscle memory is dangerous. Mm-hmm. Lauren's a big question, Lauren Scott.
Yeah, right. Does that get us close, do you think? I think that gets us close.
Let me just answer the last one, because I don't ever feel guilty for financial being a motivating factor, mostly because I very rarely shoot stuff just for financial reasons. I mean, I never feel icky taking pictures for money, because I don't take the kind of work, or I don't get offered the kind of work that makes me feel icky. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, like I'm lucky enough to not have to be just like, oh, I got to hold my nose and take this picture of this guy, even though I don't really want to.
What would be a job, for example, and if you don't feel comfortable answering this, we'll move on. But what would be a job that you would turn down?
I mean, I often get emails or calls from people who want me to take pictures of their kids, you know, that kind of stuff, mm-hmm, which is just mm-hmm, not my mm-hmm. cup of tea. If somebody said, we want you to come in and do, you know, on white headshots for our website of 75 people. I've done some of that stuff before, you know, like I've worked with companies where I've gone in and done a handful of these things for, you know, their C-level people or whatever it is.
Sure.
But if you said it was just going to be this cookie cutter thing, basically like school pictures for a company, I would have a hard time saying yes to that, even though, you know, because a lot of those times they don't pay very much. They pay like $150, $200 a person. You know what I mean? Like with all of the post-production and everything, it doesn't work out to be all that much money, you know? So even if you're shooting 20 people and you walk out with $3,000, it's like, well, I got to edit 20 people's pictures and I, you know, got to go there and got to deal with these people and, you know, retouch 30 pictures or whatever. It's like, it starts losing its interest, you know? So those kinds of things I'd have a problem with. But it's very rare that I'd say no. I mean, I think if, I sometimes I think of more like high level stuff. Like if Philip Morris asked me to shoot a campaign for them, I don't know how I feel about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Or Budweiser. Like I'm not into drinking, so like you know, I don't know how I'd feel about that.
Call Freddie Clark.
Yeah, exactly. Call Freddie. But so yeah, so there are little things like that, but those are just sort of personal hangups.
Right. Sure.
Any sort of thing. So, yeah, I don't know. But yeah. Anyway, Lauren, there's your question.
If we need to go around again, write in again, podcast it on Taking Pictures.
I'm sure we did a terrible job on that.
I'm sure we did too, but hopefully it was at least entertaining.
Jeffrey's like tipping his top hat right now.
I am. I'm wearing a top hat right now and a monocle. So there's
that. Have you ever worn a monocle? You ever hold onto a monocle like in your eye?
Maybe.
Have you really?
I think I did in college because they had them in the costume department. I was like, oh look, I'm Mr. Peanut.
Are you Mr. Peanut?
That's
weird.
It is. Maybe I'll go as Mr. Peanut for Halloween or something.
This episode of Haunting Pictures.
Anything to get out of my shell.
Oh. So bad.
Stop it, you salty dog.
This episode of Haunting Pictures is brought to you by the great people at Squarespace.
Squarespace.
You can use Squarespace to create a beautiful website that'll turn your cool ideas into...
Upside down. Oh, no.
That'll turn them upside down. That's exactly what we're going to say. You want to showcase your work. You want to blog or publish your content. You want to sell products and services of all kinds. If you want to promote your physical or online business, you want to announce an upcoming event or special project, you can do all of that and more with Squarespace. I've got beautiful templates created by world-class designers, powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online, the ability to customize look and feel, settings, products, and more with just a few clicks. Everything is optimized for mobile right out of the box, so your stuff will look great on phones and iPads. You know, it's funny, just a quick aside. It's crazy that, remember when mobile was an afterthought on websites?
Yeah. Yeah. And there were all these different companies that had, you know, mobile plugins or mobile only. Yeah. I do remember that.
It's funny.
I'm glad that's gone.
Yeah. And Squarespace is a new way to buy domains and choose from over 200 extensions. Extensions. I want to find out about these extensions.
There are 200 extensions?
Apparently. Analytics that'll help you grow in real time. I like analytics. The Squarespace analytics have really improved over the past few years. Built-in search engine optimization, free secure hosting, free and secure hosting, nothing to patch or upgrade ever, and 24/7 award-winning customer support. They're fantastic. You know, make it with Squarespace. Create a powerful website all by yourself. So, you know, Destiny is calling, Jeffrey. It says you need a new website. Make it with Squarespace.
I'm going to pick up. Yes, Destiny? May I help you? Hello, Destiny.
So go check out squarespace.com for your free trial. And when you're ready to purchase, use the offer code OTP to save 10% off your first purchase of a domain or a website. Thank you so much for Squarespace for supporting 5x5 and our show on Taking Pictures. You know, the other day, I had a blog post I wrote months ago that I wasn't allowed to post for, you know, reasons of waiting for people to allow me to post it. And then I couldn't find it the other day when I wanted to put it up. I'm like, I thought I just made a draft of it. And you know what I mean? You know, sometimes you write a draft. And I was like, where is that thing? There's no way I would have deleted it, you know, because it took me a long time to let, you know, write it out and blah, blah, blah. And it turns out, on my last iteration of my site, I had created a whole other second blog to have sort of like news and releases or whatever it is. And I didn't realize that it was in there. And so I had to like move it over to just the general thing because I only have a single blog now.
Right.
But it's one of those things where you forget, even inside of Squarespace or whatever, oh, I'm just going to create a whole second blog over here for this specific purpose, you know, like my daily thing or whatever, you know. There's a good example. I could have used a whole other blog just for my daily portraits and put them up there as like a blog feed.
Can you point now? I haven't looked at this in a while with Squarespace. Can you point multiple domains to different folders?
No, I think I don't. You know what? That's a good question. Well, I guess you could.
You could do it on your.
You could do like a redirect at your host. Your domain hosting company, right?
And then, just do a, yeah. Right.
Like you did for Photography by Letter originally.
Yeah.
Do you still do it that way? Does it jump over to
Sidoris?
No, it has its own now.
It has its own thing.
But for a
now.
While it didn't, right?
Yeah. And I'm actually thinking about splitting it back up and using Squarespace for the show, for Process Driven. Yep. I like the way that the audio blocks work and all that. So
audio blocks work pretty good.
Yeah, they do some great stuff. The analytics are still, and not nobody's really, huh?
Not enough for you?
Well, the podcast analytics, nobody's really nailed it yet.
Yeah.
Because
you have to go spend a lot of money if you want to.
Well, even that, they don't count all the stuff. I mean, you've got Stitcher, you've got Spotify. Is it streamed? Is it downloaded? Because some of these, like Stitcher, to my knowledge, they mirror the actual file.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I thought they switched recently where they actually have it downloading each time or something.
Do they? Okay, that would be something new. It just seems like the podcasting analytics game, there's a lot of room for improvement.
Yeah. Or maybe we're getting to the point where, man, podcasts, I was thinking about this the other day because somebody was like, oh, they have a new podcast. And I was like, man, I was in podcasts when it wasn't cool. You know?
Right. A lot of people think our podcast still isn't cool.
Well, they're right. but you know what I'm saying? Like there's this thing where podcasts are suddenly this huge, giant, big business to the point where, you know, all these incumbents are coming in and kind of sucking all the air out of the whole thing.
Right.
It feels a little bit like that. And maybe I'm wrong. Interesting nonetheless. Anyway. Hey, so there's this thing on CNN the other day that I thought was kind of cool.
Did we pass up Frank's thing? Are we gonna come back to that?
We'll get to that next week. I don't think we have a lot of time today.
Yeah. Okay. We'll circle back.
There was a interactive thing, 20 designs that define the modern world on CNN last week.
Right.
And one of them, number three, is the original Leica camera.
Which, no offense, is a horrible looking camera.
Yeah, the original one, the 1923 version.
It looks like something that like a steampunk kid made in his basement.
Yeah.
You know,
remember,
what I mean?
It is 1923.
I know, but it just
Would you if someone said, "Here's one for your shelf," would you take one?
A Leica?
Yeah. Like an original one, like a 1923
yeah,
one.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, gonna get in trouble for this.
Okay.
I'm not a huge Leica fan.
That's because you look with your left eye.
Well, not just that. I mean, in terms of like a rangefinder, if somebody said you can have any rangefinder you want, I think the Nikon S2 is really sexy. I like the Voigtlander Bessa series. There's one that they made, the Bessa in olive green. Man, is that a sexy camera. I don't know. There just seems to be too much expectation surrounding Leica.
I think that's more of what it is. I think it's an excellent design. I think it's just like slightly, I still think it's the best, but I think it's overhyped. Does that make sense?
I'll tell you, I love the design of this little CNN page. This is nice.
Yeah, it's not bad, right?
With the overlays and the red down the right side. That's sexy.
Yeah. Wait, make it bigger. And the red goes down the left side.
Oh, wait a minute.
Or at least it does on mine.
Oh yeah, look at that.
Flips to the left.
Yeah, it flips back and forth. It swipes across. That's wow, I wish the photographs were actually high enough res. Look at number 15, the Brompton bike.
Oh,
really
pixely.
Seen, yeah. Ugh.
The but man, look at that. Look at that M3 the guy's holding in that picture. The 1 million
Wait, which one?
The Leica page. Scroll down a little bit and there's a guy holding
The
1 millionth M, which was a M3. Yeah. There's a lot of those things out there. Anyway, all these designs are actually really beautiful. The London Tube map is in there.
Yep. Is the thing that Vignelli did for the NYC, is that in there?
I think these are more products more than...
So it's like
the Braun record player. Sputnik.
Oh, yeah. Oh, look at that. The original Coca-Cola bottle. That's a sexy bottle.
Yeah. So it's just... anyway, I just thought it was interesting. The original Mini car. That's pretty cool. The Mini skirt. Interesting.
Well, Sputnik. Look at that.
Yeah, Sputnik is a pretty good option.
Oh, man, that Braun record player is sexy.
Yeah. Anyway, I just thought that it was kind of cool that a camera is in that list of things, you know. Even though the kids nowadays, they don't know what cameras are. They think cameras
the FedEx
thing in their
logo.
iPhone.
Interesting.
Is it in there?
Yeah.
FedEx logo is pretty good.
It's genius. And once you see that arrow, you can't unsee
it. Can't unsee it.
That's
it's kind of sucks your will to live a little bit.
Right.
Hey, you've got an appointment to go to. So let's, why don't we jump over to the group and keep this one slightly short.
The dentist. I'm going to the dentist.
I know, man. You should go to my dentist. She's the best.
Everybody says that their dentist is
She's actually the best. She's our buddy. We have dinner with our dentist.
Wait, what was it? Oh, saturation.
Yeah, saturation.
Although, you know what? I'm going to go back to photo sharing here just for a minute.
All right.
There's some cool pictures just in photo sharing this week. Nick Govis, Sunset Yoga in Williamsburg. It looks like a very 80s kind of...
Yeah, who is that girl?
I don't know, but...
It's like she's from Breakin' 2.
Right, Electric Boogaloo. She's got the Electric Boogaloo, Bill. Is her hair green or is it just my screen? Is there kind of a yellowy green tint?
There is a green tinge to her hair.
Yeah, okay. All right. But anyway, that's a cool shot.
That's because she's cooler than our podcast.
Right. Right. Hugh, friend of the show, Hugh Tallman.
There's cranberry bogs on the mall.
Apparently there were.
What was that for?
Cranberry bog day? I don't know.
Yeah, and Hugh's got a communion thing. Is Hugh a religious gentleman?
Yes.
Oh, interesting. Yes. I don't think I knew that.
Has an amazing, like, he is one of those people that has an amazing recall of historical and religious knowledge. He's one of those people that are amazing to talk to because it's all just like right there at his fingertips.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Edward De La Torre, I love that shot looking up the stairwell.
Hey, look at that. Chris Fuller one at Yellowstone National Park where it's the windows.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a nice shot.
Yeah. So keep sharing. These are some terrific photographs.
All right. Where's let's see the assignments here.
All right. So
I want to get I'm going to close my eyes. I'm going to open them. Hopefully, I will get blasted back by the saturation.
You burn your retinas from the saturation. Timoteo, Johnny went riding. Yeah, he did.
Woo.
Kenneth Wilson, I like the effect that you've got on that light there, Kenneth. That's pretty cool. I'd like to start doing some night photography.
Night photography deserves a quiet night. I like Benjamin's picture with just, it's pretty mono except for the orange stripe coming in. It's kind of nice.
Oh yeah.
Bruce
yeah,
DeBolt's like got the lantern, super bright. Tom Spalding. Ooh, look at that. It's like, would you say that's sort of a violet? It's the kind of blue violet.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The guitar player.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Jens, Copenhagen Central with just the red blur of a handbag or something. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Can't go wrong with the color blur. Now, okay, look at Jim Nash's picture down there of the yellow with the red. Architectural sort of triangular.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love that. Wow, yeah, that's okay. Cool.
That's the kind of stuff that I see that I go, oh, yeah, I've taken pictures like that before. I should take out my camera, take stuff, like go find weird angular things like that. You know what I mean? That's the kind of stuff I was trying to explain that I have been into in the past and feel like I should go back to doing a little bit of. Ooh, look at Patrick Marr's picture of the top of that mountain with the green. Oh, look at that.
Man. Like Millie's picture of Leonard Cohen, that big street mural of Leonard Cohen.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's cool. Where was that? I went by it.
Right next to the Jim Nash picture.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
WWQ. A lot of people talking about my notebook meltdown. You know what? Maybe we should do. Hey, those of you, I got an idea. Those of you who do notebooks, who are fans of the notebooks, what if we did a notebook exchange? Where
Wait,
you we trade
that was
our
me
favorite
being fielding for a second.
Yeah. What? Yeah. We trade our favorite notebooks. Like, here, this is my current favorite notebook. I'll send you my current favorite notebook. You send me your current favorite.
Like, these are not used, unused?
Like a new one.
A new unused. One. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. A new notebook. Like, I love the, if you love the Field Notes, or you love Word, or you love Rhodia, or, you know, Moleskine, or whatever it is, maybe we could do like a little notebook exchange.
What was the cheap set of three that you told me to buy on Amazon that time that I never got around to doing?
Maybe it was the Moleskine.
It wasn't Moleskine. It was some other brand.
Oh, was it Rhodia? Might have been Rhodia.
How do you spell that?
R-H-O-D-I-A.
Rhodia. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Could have been.
Or it might have been Word. Word notebooks.
I think that might be it.
Three for $10, I think.
Yeah. That's.
Or you can get 10 for 25.
You, and these are all right? The paper's all right and everything?
I've never used the Word ones. A lot of people love them even more than the Field Notes. They say that the paper is better, particularly for fountain pens, which I use fountain pens. I love fountain pens, even though I'm a lefty.
Who would have thought that notebooks
would be a thing?
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
It's a little crazy.
It is. So thank you, Aaron Draplin.
Yeah. Wait, who's Aaron Draplin?
Aaron Draplin created Field Notes.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Along with Jim Koodle.
Oh, okay.
Nick Van Zanten. That's a saturate photo. Look at all those. Those are good looking group of kids. Look at that. What is that? M-W. M-H-M-S? Oh, look at those.
Yeah.
Band?
Yeah, middle school kids. Band kids.
Yeah.
I can almost hear them. And they're just like, no, we were playing September by Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Right. Fernando Carvalho da Silva. This one is, it's easy. If you were in a month, in India, I'd like to go to India. I think it'd be a tough place to go, but I'd like to go. That's a beautiful shot.
And John Krill's speaking to me over here, this big giant Coca-Cola truck. I look at Vicky Brown's. Look at Vicky Brown's still life shot she put in late. Of the baseball glove on the plate.
Oh yeah,
from low that's angle. Nice. Very nice. Very Eggleston. Nice.
Yeah, the vignette's a little heavy.
I have no problem with the vignette.
All right,
Vicky, don't listen to him.
Don't listen to me. I don't know.
Right,
some good stuff this year.
What did we come up with this morning? Oh, right. Early morning. Assignment.
Yeah. Since we're up doing this early morning.
You should be too, damn it.
You should be. Hey, I'll tell you what, it's better than when I was on the West Coast and, you know, I would get up at 5 to do it.
Yeah, that was, by the way, that was your choice. I don't think I ever forced you to.
No. I'm not claiming that you did. Bill wouldn't let me sleep in.
Bill,
man,
used to beat me. That's and then right. He would
get up and do the dance, monkey.
Pretty much. Yeah, what time did you get up?
We did
the show at 6 a.m. your time.
6 a.m. my time. Yeah, because it was 9 a.m. here.
It was 9 a.m. my time. Oh god.
For like 3 years.
Yeah. Hey, it worked. I thought you liked getting up that early. I didn't know.
I do. I mean, I was up anyway, you know.
All right, what's your thing of the week?
All right, photographer of the week. This week, I thought this was timely given the Ken Burns documentary. Larry Burroughs, probably most famous for his photographs of Vietnam. One photograph in particular in this Time magazine article is the kind of iconic Larry Burroughs shot. But he was one of the photographers who kind of put a human face on the war in Vietnam with his color photographs. Very gritty, looked like an awful place.
Yeah. Have you watched, how much of the documentary have you watched? All of it?
None. Zero.
Okay.
I have not seen it.
Conrad and I are 3 episodes in just because we just hit walls and are just sort of like, oh God, I need to take a break, you know?
Yeah, I would imagine it's pretty heavy.
Interestingly enough, the picture from 1971 in Laos just before his death, he's got a like.
Yeah, wasn't it a helicopter crash? Helicopter was shot down or something?
Yeah, he died with fellow journalist Henri Huet, K. Ken Potter and Kyesaburo Shimamoto when their helicopter was shot down over Laos.
Yeah.
2002, Burroughs' posthumous book of Vietnam was awarded the Prix Nadar Award. At the time of the helicopter crash, the photographers were covering the Operation Lam Son 719, a massive armored invasion of Laos by South Vietnamese forces against the VPA and Pathet Lao. Wow. Interesting. Oh my God. In 2008, the scant remains of Burroughs and fellow photographers were honored and interred at the new museum in Washington,
D.C. Here in Washington, D.C., which I still have not been to.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I'm gonna put all this in the show notes. Sorry, you were getting back to his actual stuff. British guy, I didn't know he was British. Somehow, I didn't realize that.
From this Time magazine article, yep. Portrait from Hell, Larry Burroughs reaching out is the title of that particular photograph from 1966.
Yep.
In October 1966, on a mud splattered hill just south of the DMZ. In Vietnam, Life magazine's Larry Burroughs made a photograph that, for generations, has served as the most indelible, searing illustration of the horrors inherent in that long, divisive war, and by implication, in all wars. Go read this article. It's a terrific article. And there are what works out to basically a roll of photographs, 22 photographs in this slideshow. Very similar in style to the work of Tim Hetherington, who...
Yeah.
Also, sadly, died while doing his job.
You know, we were actually having a conversation about this the other day at the coffee shop up the hill. We have, you know, friends we see on Saturdays who sit down and we talk in the coffee shop. And I was talking to this guy, Alan, who I actually shot a couple of days ago, who is, older than us, 20 years older. So he was around during this time in a way that I was not. And we're just talking about the fact of you know, World War II. The press was cordoned off, very controlled. Nowadays, ever since the first Iraq war, the press are embedded in the military units. It's all very structured. In the Vietnam documentary, Ken Burns talks about these guys going and just journalists just going and saying, hey, you're going there. Can I hop on the helicopter with you and go with you? And
right.
And the military wasn't locking down on it. And I think these kinds of pictures, which are the kinds of things you get when you're not being told what you can shoot and what you can't shoot, is what changes the way people feel about wars and that kind of stuff. So in some ways, war journalism now, especially if you are embedded in doing it by the rules, you're one step away from propaganda in some ways.
There's still an agenda on some level. Yeah.
So it's
in this Time magazine article, at number 15.
All right, let me go back.
American Marines receive the sacrament. Communion. Ugh, just reckon me with that.
Yeah, yeah. Because this is what God had in mind, you know?
Yeah, ugh. Yeah.
I also like, interestingly enough, how the later, from 17 to 22, is how they were shown in the magazine originally, which is actually really, really neat. Amazing. Very, very good find.
I bet you could find this magazine on eBay.
Oh, I'm sure you could. Are you into saving magazines?
Yes.
Okay.
Life
magazine. I don't know why I asked that question.
October 1966. Yep, there it is. $12.
There you go.
You know what? I think I'm going to buy it.
Look at you.
Free standard shipping from Marion, Indiana. Item condition very good. Yeah, October 28th, 1966. The cover image in this one is...
The right one?
It's not Invasion from the North. It is, number 17. That's the cover of this particular issue on eBay.
Okay.
Yeah, wow. I think I'd like to have that. Just as a folio of his work.
Yep. And to see how contrasty and not great printing was back in the 1960s.
right. we talk about cameras coming a long way, but Jesus, the printing technology has gotten phenomenally better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Whole other thing.
Yeah. All right. So Larry Burroughs, go check out Larry's work, and by means of extension, check out if you're not familiar with him, Tim Hetherington.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Let's find a link for Tim.
I think still timhetherington.com works, and his documentary, there's
Tim Hetherington Trust.com.
Okay. Restrepo is his film.
Oh, right. Yeah. Classic.
Which is terrific. Yeah. About the, was it Korngal Valley? Is that how you pronounce that? Korngal Valley in Afghanistan.
Yeah. I'll put a link to that as well. Man, all this war. Honestly, you watch this Vietnam thing, and you know, each episode is an hour and a half or 2 hours or whatever. Right. And it's just mentally exhausting. Yeah. I mean, you watch it and you're just like overwhelmed by bad decisions. There's a scene in there where early in LBJ's time, when he was still had, you know, McNamara and all these guys be around him. By the way, if you haven't seen Fog of War, which is, one of the greatest documentaries of all time, which is all about, in fact, oh, look at that. Somebody has it on Vimeo.
Nice.
Fog of War, 11 Lessons from the Life of Robert McNamara. You should definitely watch that. It's amazing. Mm-hmm, Interviews with him are illuminating. Anyway, they sit in a room, and apparently he told everyone in the room, it was like the Joint Chiefs and, you know, his Secretary of State and all the rest of it. And they were all in the room, and he said, look, we have two options. We either get out now, and this is 1964 or 65. We either get out now, or we go all in. And if we go all in, I give us a 1 in 3 chance of being successful. And Everyone in the room chose the second.
Yeah. Go all in. Well, it's just, yeah.
Cause you know what? Penises.
Right. I have a friend who, this friend's father was a Green Beret, and one of three, I think, to survive a grenade attack on their, platoon. But he was there in like 1962 when
right in the beginning, CIA was doing
nobody
most
was
of
supposed
it.
To be there.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Got anything else?
No. Go take pictures. Go be purposeful in your photographs.
Let's see, 347-687-9411. Leave us a voicemail like some people do. It's very nice. We love them. Yep. podcast@ontakingpictures.com. We'll send an email to the two of us, and, at Bill Wadman, at Jeffrey Sidoris, photographerbytheletter.com. Is that everything?
Yep. Hey, can you, well, I'll talk to you about it offline.
Okay.
That's all right. Yeah. So, go, you know, watch some things, go read some things, go see a movie, go see Blade Runner. We're going to see Blade Runner.
Conrad's going with Ali. I think they're going to have a good time.
Reviews are spectacular so far.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. Wired raved about it. IGN gave it a 9.8. Lots of people are saying that it absolutely equals, and in many ways
surpasses the original. Unbelievable. I don't believe
it. I don't know that I believe that.
It's not only unbelievable, I don't believe it.
I don't believe, I mean, Ryan Gosling is dreamy and all, but come on.
Hey, girl.
Right. You know he saved Jazz, right?
He's so good.
Go watch the opening monologue for SNL.
Okay.
It's pretty funny.
I'll check that. All right. We'll see y'all later.
We'll see you next week. Thank you for listening, everyone. Have a great week.
Going on and on the way we are for so something's wrong. As this way